I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 136 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Our guest this week is a soulful singer, songwriter, and performer who happens to be famous for producing some great rock albums, Don Dixon. I first knew of Dixon as the co-producer of REM's game-changing first two albums, Murmur and Reckoning. Former Caro Pop guest Mitch Easter had produced the band's initial single and EP before Dixon was brought in to work with his old friend. Dixon discusses here what he brought to the table. I hadn't realized that by that time, Dixon had already spent 13 years playing bass, singing, and writing songs for a key band in the local indie movement, Arrogance, from North Carolina. How did he weigh the performing and producing sides of his career? Dixon went solo, and I snapped my fingers along to Praying Mantis from his 1985 solo debut, Most of the Girls Like to Dance, But Only Some of the Boys Like to. That same year, he produced Marty Jones's album, Unsophisticated Time, which features covers of artists I like, such as Elvis Costello and the DBs. He married her, and the two have lived in Ohio for many years. Side note, on my favorite holiday music compilation, Yule Tunes, Jones and Dixon sing a duet of Every Day Will Be Like a Holiday, written by Caro Pop guest William Bell. Every day will be like a holiday. Dixon recorded several albums for Enigma Records, but gained more prominence for another band he produced for that indie label, The Smithereens. I was blown away when I first heard the snarling guitars and sweet melodies of the songs Blood and Roses and Behind the Wall of Sleep from Smithereens' 1986 debut album, Especially for You. Dixon produced that album and the successful follow-up, Green Thoughts. Like Easter, Dixon gained a reputation for producing southern jangle bands, but the albums he worked on boasted a certain toughness, such as Guadalcanal Diaries, Walking in the Shadow of the Big Man, 2x4, and Flip Flop. He also produced The Windbreakers, Matthew Sweet, Marshall Crenshaw, Hootie and the Blowfish, and Tommy Keane. And Nirvana approached him about producing Nevermind. There's a story there, which is fortunate because Dixon is a great storyteller, a guy you'd want to hang out with inside or outside the studio. Now you get to do that. So please enjoy part two of this Caro Pop conversation with Don Dixon.
You'll never forget me. Oh, I promise that much.
Were you getting approached by a lot of other bands that were in that, you know, kind of jangly genre at that point? I mean, you started producing Guadalcanal Diary in 84 also.
Yeah, Guadalcanal Diary. I'm sure a lot of the things I started getting offered were because of REM's success. I mean, I met Marty because of REM's success. I mean, her band here in Akron that was signed to A&M would never have called me if they hadn't loved Murmur. You know, I got calls from Nirvana because they loved Smithereens and Murmur. And I don't know whether the Smithereens called me because of Murmur or tracked me down because of that or because of our, Marty and I had kind of a big presence in New York anyway. So, but yes, I mean, that was the first kind of important record I think I probably ever made. But I'd been making records all along. And and Arrogance, like I said, had been recording around the country. And so I had a lot of experience. But there's no question that the success of REM caused me to probably get calls from Danny Beard and to do Guadalcanal Diary, which is one of the great bands I think ever.
Right. Yeah. And that album 2x4 is terrific. And I love that song Litany.
Litany is great. And that sort of Litany kind of sets the tone for what Murray did like in his solo career after that.
Did you get sort of involved in, you know, these bands you're producing, like thinking, oh, I hope this is really commercially successful? Or was that not really part of your purview as a producer?
Well, I never, you know, there's that great Saturday Night Live skit about the cowbell.
Right.
What's the actor's name that plays the producer?
Christopher Walken. And they called him Jim Dickinson in that too. And I'm like, there is a Jim Dickinson. So
yeah, no. And there were a lot of funny references in that skit. But he comes in and goes, "Hey, I put on my pants one leg at a time like everybody else. But once my pants are on, I make hit records. So I never quite felt like I was the guy who would make your hit record for you. But I would, to me, the most important thing is that you're not miserable when you're making the record. I don't want people to have a miserable experience. I want people to feel like they had fun while they were making that record. At least there's a lot of hard work involved. You can't get away from the hard work, but it doesn't have to be miserable hard work.
Were some bands happier than others? And did that kind of come out in the actual records then?
Bands all being made up of human beings, yes, some were happier than others because human beings are all very different. I don't know whether I can point to things to say this record wasn't as good as it could have been because somebody was sad and grumpy. I don't have those kind of memories. I mean, the first Guadalcanal Diary record we made in 5 days. I mean, the whole thing, all the recordings, all the mixes. I would put on a reel of tape and there'd be four songs on it. And Murray would just, I would never stop the tape. He would just sing through the songs so I could get lead vocals. The first Smithereens record, 5 days, maybe in New York City. They had cut two tracks before that. A wonderful engineer named Jim Ball was helping them at one of the famous Hit Factory, I think, is where we recorded that record. And so, you know, having 3 weeks to make a record was kind of a luxury. Like, I mean, Murmur, we set aside enough time to really not have everything be under such pressure. And I always have recorded a lot of my own stuff, one song at a time, you know, here and there. So especially solo stuff, because right, the pressure is not on. So like Mitch said, I'm always finding songs of yours at the end of people's sessions. So like I'd do a session and there'd be tape left at the end of the session. So I'd record something at the end of the tape and then forget it was there, make a mix. And then I'd never think about it again and forget where the masters even were.
Yeah, I told Dennis Dykin this when I talked to him, but I was driving home from college and driving back from Philadelphia, and it was like a 14-hour drive, and it's like 2 in the morning, and I put on XRT, or I had on XRT, and I was excited when it came into range so I could like listen to my hometown rock station. And for the first time, I heard do 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 do, and I heard and I heard Blood and Roses, Smithereens, for the first time, and I was like, you know, again, it's like the end of a long day of driving. I was just like, what is this? This song is so cool. And you produced that. They recorded it. Fantastic. Yes. Yes. Song.
It's one of those things, you know, Mike Maceras came up with that bass part, even though Pat Denizou would probably tell you that he wrote the bass part. Pat and I became great friends, all those guys, really. I love those guys. And that was a band that really, that you can kind of see some of their antecedents. But Pat's voice and Jim's guitar stuff, I mean, and Dennis, unbelievable drummer. So, no, they were four very, that was a really great band. And they're still a great band. They're just, it's different without Pat.
So you make the first record, especially for you, then the second one was Green Thoughts. Was that, again, sort of like a Murmur Reckoning sort of thing where they came in and they had a little more confidence and, you know, wanted to rock it up a little more the second one? Or
especially for you, it was just a blur of making this record. It was the last week of December and whatever year that was. It was just crazy blur and a cool record, but it was like a lot of work on everybody's part. And
covers a lot of stylistic ground too, especially for you. I mean, you know, in a lonely place and cigarette and all that stuff. And, you know, and then you have the big power pop anthems.
Yeah, exactly. And we had a lot of guests on that record. A lot of guests came in. They were signed to Enigma at the time, which was also my label. And then Capitol stole them from Enigma before Green Thoughts. So we had a bigger budget and a little more time. Still only, I think we spent maybe 3 weeks. But we had, we recorded in the tower, one of their classic Capitol studios, Green Thoughts. And it was fun. And they had a bunch of great songs, even though Pat was still writing words right up until the last minute. But, you know, he was really something, you know. And so it wasn't like REM in that regard, in terms of an A and a B. It was much more of a concentrated move up into the rock world in their second record. REM's was a little more parallel, as I think, as a when you hold those records side by side. Even though the Smithereens' style didn't change that much, I think their attitude changed even more.
Hmm. Now, were you disappointed when they moved on to Ed Stasium for the third record?
Oh, no, I love Ed. And Ed did a great job. And Ed's the one that was able to have all the hits for him, you know, which is God bless him. You know, Ed's terrific. And no, I'm never disappointed because I really don't like producing that much. So it's fun for me whenever I don't have to.
Dennis Dykin liked how the record sounded, but didn't like that Ed used click tracks.
Well, you're talking about the Stasium records.
Yeah, 11.
Yeah, I would never have made, I don't ever make anybody use a click track. If a drummer really wants to use one for some reason on something, I did a session, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago with, the guy who played with Little Village, you know, Keltner.
Oh, Jim Keltner, yeah.
Yeah, I made a record with Jim a few years ago when he was a drummer. And there was one song he really wanted a click. And I said, you don't need a fucking click. And he said, no, I really want some. So I let him make his own click. I let him make his own loop out of some percussion noises to play to. But I really don't like, I don't like what happens when you put clicks on things. But that's just, you know, that's just me.
Right. Ed Stasium liked it because he could edit stuff together easier if he was using this bit from this take and this bit from this take. And I think you're more into sort of just getting the full take.
Well, no, I edit a lot. I've got lots and lots of records. Well, I have one record in particular with 37 cuts on the 2-inch tape, 37 edits in it. So it's just, you don't have to have things on a click to do edits. That's all. There are plenty of edits on Kinda Blue, and I promise you there's no click track.
So, and with Smithereens, you know, then you came back and did Date with Smithereens in 94 and 2011. So yeah. you're coming back to this band at various stages of its career. Were the dynamics different each time you did it, or do they all just become the same every time?
No, the dynamics are always different. I mean, there was always kind of a lot of tension, you know, which was less musical and more business. As a band is together longer and they're more successful, and you know, you start having business tensions creep in. So I think there was the biggest difference really with the Smithereens records was just, you know, more tension over the money and who gets to write songs, you know, because the money also starts rolling into songwriting and people start realizing, I mean, Glenn Frey and Don Henley started writing songs because they realized they weren't making, if they wrote the songs, they'd make more money. I mean, it's that simple. They weren't writing songs that much early on. So,
well, it seems like one of the ways that REM was able to stick together was they just split the publishing right from the start. So you didn't have those, because there's so many bands that seems like they blow up because, you know, someone's making so much money, more money than someone else, because, you know, in the Go-Go's, you have like, you know, Charlotte's making the money and Jane's making the money, but Belinda singing the songs, but not getting the songwriting royalties. And that just caused all this stuff.
It's all true. And that is a problem. I mean, because ideally bands are little communist communities, and I've always encouraged bands to split the songwriting in some way that makes sense to everyone. But that's where egos do sometimes get involved, and accountants. But you know, in a situation, let's use it Smithereens as an example. After, you know, Green Thoughts was gold, you know, especially if you use a gold record, but a gold record still doesn't mean that much money for the guys in the band, but it means a lot for the guy who wrote the songs. So it's like Pat had a lot more money than the rest of the guys in that band after those two records because of the songwriting end of it, both in performance and just mechanicals on sales, whereas the other guys are still just, you know, not, they don't have that. They have whatever they have planned live, you know?
Right. And when you did Date with the Smithereens, they were coming off of what might have been considered their first commercial disappointment, and that Blow Up was not as big of a hit as 11. So I don't know whether that would have added extra pressure on them, you know, coming into the studio with you, like, oh, we need to do this album to rebound or something like that.
I think we were excited because they had moved to RCA, and RCA seemed really happy to have them. You know, we were still friends. We'd stayed in touch. I'd made a solo record with Pat at that point already, I think. And, you know, it was sort of a time of transition for them. It's hard to maintain, you know, it's hard to have hits when the landscape was changing the way it was between 11 and Blow Up. I mean, And the Smithereens were never like they were never like Cinderella or AC/DC or Aerosmith. I mean, people forget Aerosmith would be like still considered like a sort of a B Coliseum band had Walk This Way not been elevated by Run DMC to this whole new stratospheric level, because. You know, but I'm not going to disparage Aerosmith too much, but you know, you get where I'm coming from.
Sure.
And the Smithereens were never a glamorous. They didn't have a glamorous, slithery lead singer. You know, they had Pat, who was this incredible powerhouse, but was not a glamorous and slithery guy.
Just an amazing voice. That's
and,
all.
And a writer, you know, I mean, you can't, yeah. that whole band, their collective sound was just something. It's hard to quantify any of that, I think.
Part of what changed, you know, the landscape for Smithereens was, you know, grunge had become, you know, very big in between, you know, 11 and Blow Up coming out. And, I think Blow Up came out around the time that Nevermind was blowing up, and you talked to Nirvana about producing Nevermind. So like, what happened with that?
Well, I actually went out and we hung out for a couple of days, and I loved them. I mean, I got Gary Gersh sent me a cassette with four songs on it. I think Lithium was on it. They were recordings that Butch had made, of the band before Dave Grohl became drummer. And they were great. They're great recordings. And I loved it. I said, oh yeah, I'll come out and see them. And I think they were as interested in me. I mean, Gersh had been a fan of me as a writer and a performer, as well as, a producer for a long time. And, we just not ever really worked on anything together, still haven't, but he was interested in Arrogance. Gary was very aware of Arrogance and helped unbeknownst to me with my long-term publishing deal at Bug Music. back in the old days when he gave his roommate an Arrogance cassette that had a bunch of songs of mine, like Praying Mantis on it and stuff. I think they were as interested. Nirvana was interested more in my involvement with the Smithereens than REM in terms of sound. They did the right thing. I mean, Butch, I would never have insisted on double tracking vocals or anything. So I think they made the right decision by letting Butch push them around a little bit more.
Right. So they expressed interest in you, and you came and met with them, but then ended up not doing it?
Well, I thought we were going to do it because we got along really well. And then I think we tried to get too much money. I think my manager tried to get too much money out of Geffen, which was actually not that much. It was the kind of what we were charging everybody at the time. But it seemed like a lot of money to the Nirvana guys. And I think they made the right decision, obviously.
They did fine with Butch Vig, but it would have been cool if you got to do it.
Yeah. No, I wanted Butch to help. I'd met Butch when he was in a band on Atlantic that had talked to me about producing them. So I didn't know him, but I had met him, and I was really impressed with these demos that he had done. And they said, well, we really like Butch. And I said, well, Butch can come help, So, I mean, Butch was going to help on that record anyway. So when I thought I was going to do it.
Do you remember hearing that album for the first time?
Yeah, it's a great record. But people don't give the Pixies enough credit for influencing the sort of approach that they take, that sort of loud, soft thing,
Right. Well, and adding Dave Grohl made a difference, too.
Well, Grohl was in the band when I went out there, but he had only been playing for a little while. Maybe 3 or 4 weeks as the drummer. And he was great, but he was sort of quiet because I listened to him play some songs. They were doing some sort of version of Smells Like Teen Spirit, but I'm not sure there were any words yet or any words that mattered at that point. I loved him though. I would love to have done that record, but it might not have been as successful if I had done it.
I'm sure it would have done pretty well regardless, because those songs and the sound. You probably wouldn't have. Weren't there like some looped drums on there?
I mean, there were all kinds of things I probably wouldn't have done, starting with the double tracked vocal stuff. But Butch, his band was sort of a hair band. They were like a real classic kind of, I can't remember, Firehouse or something like that. And he went on to make great stuff. I love that Garbage. The Garbage records are great.
Carolpop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. What beer really hits the spot on Memorial Day weekend and beyond? Cold Time, Revolution's premium lager. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's never pasteurized, and the brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a slow, lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. Cold Time is available in 12 packs of 12-ounce cans. So 85 is like right in where you've done Murmur and Reckoning was 84, and you've done Guadalcanal Diary, their first record, and you're gonna do the Smithereens, and then you had a hit with Praying Mantis.
Well, sort of.
Well, in Chicago, it was a hit. I heard that a ton on XRT. You had a video on MTV. So those recordings that were on that album with the concise title of Most of the Girls Like to Dance, but Only Some of the Boys Like to. Were those Arrogance recordings, or were they demos, or did you sort of make a new album based on these songs that you had?
The Praying Mantis is 80% the recording that arrogance made when we were making a demo to try to get a new deal after Warner Brothers. I added some singing and remixed it. I might have even re-sang it myself, but I added a few things to that. But it is primarily from a two-day demo session that we did, where we recorded 16 songs. And so your Southside Girl is exactly the record that Arrogance did and actually released as a 45 in like 1982 or something. So all of those songs, not all of them, about half of those songs are directly from Arrogance, that one Arrogance demo that was done at Reflection in 82.
So did you put the album together and sell it to Enigma, or did they sign you and this is what you had?
What happened was my friend Gary Gersh gave a cassette of this demo that we were sending around to his roommate who was working at Bug Music. And Bug Music signed me to a publishing deal based on that set of songs. The owner of Bug Music, Dan Burgoyes, liked the stuff so much that he played it for his friend Andrew Lauder, who was running Elvis's new record company, Demon. I don't know how new it was, but it was fairly new, in London. And so they wanted to put it out. They said, we want to put this record out, and we want to put these songs out. So the original release was on Demon. Then it was picked up for Scandinavia by a small label called Mega. And then it was we licensed it to several other European countries. And we actually had some hits with Mega. Demon didn't do that great with it, but I played England a few times, so I never really had a hit over there. But we had big hits with Southside Girl and in Belgium and just general, what they call Benelux. And one day I'm over, and I think I'm in the Amsterdam airport, sitting in a chair waiting for my flight, and a guy walks over to me and introduces himself, and his name is Bill. He says, I am Bill Hein. I have this label in the United States called Enigma. I really love Praying Mantis. I would like to put your record out. And I said, well, I'm not interested, and thank you, though. It's nice to meet you. I'm so mad with all American record companies for not picking up this record when Arrogance tried to give it to him 3 years ago, that I just don't care. I don't want to do it. So he said, okay, well, thanks for talking to me.
And he just happened to be in Amsterdam airport at the time?
And recognized me, I guess, from the video.
Wow.
Okay.
So he kept pestering me. Not pestering, but he stayed in touch. And I said, okay, well, here's what I'll do. Here's what I'm willing to do. I'm willing to put out a single every 6 weeks. And now, mind you, this is 1985. I'm willing to put out a single every 6 weeks for the rest of my life. That's the kind of record deal I want. I don't want to make albums anymore. I want to put out two sides every 6 weeks for the rest of my life. And he said, well, let me think about that. So he thought about that, and then he finally said, nah, we can't do that, but we'll license your deal. So, but, I mean, think about what people do today. That's exactly what everyone should be doing, putting out two songs every 6 weeks. They shouldn't be messing with albums. People consume music now, like, one song at a time. It's kind of like back to 1956. I mean, albums came on the scene, you know, after there were singles ruled the airwaves.
Right. Anyway. Although with the vinyl having come back, I think there's more work in the 40-minute album genre than there used to be too, where like CDs, well, everyone was making these 72-minute albums.
But albums are actually really two 18-minute sides. They're two 18-minute bits. They're not one 40-minute bit. They really are a lot of people when I was growing up only ever listened to one side of a record, and had a favorite side, and it was always, you know, you always talked in those terms. Oh yeah, side A is great, side B sucks, side B is fantastic, side A is not so great, you know. So there are all kinds of opinions about how that works. The amount of work involved in playing an album is something that is undervalued now. But the reality is that not that many people are really buying records. I mean, when you really look at the numbers, it's just not anything like it used to be. I mean, and this is a perfect example. When they were talking to me about Nirvana, it was like, we don't want it much. You know, we want to sell maybe 100,000, you know, just hey, you imagine what selling 100,000 LPs would mean today, how far right at the top of the charts you'd be.
That was a very low estimate for what Nirvana ultimately sold on that record too.
But I mean, that's all they wanted. They wanted a, like REM or the Smithereens, really, initially, they just wanted a good college, a hit college record, a record that would sound good on college radio and sell 100,000 to sort of pay for it.
Right. But
okay, back to Bill. So anyway, so Bill offered to license the first record and then sign me to a deal. So that's how I ended up at Enigma. That was an awfully long story. Sorry.
No, it's good. And so you'd already made the video for Praying Mantis for all these, you know, European releases of it?
No. We made the Praying Mantis video, who is the same guy who did South Central Rain, by the way. He's a guy named Howard Leboff from Atlanta.
Okay.
That was an Enigma thing to make that video. I didn't make that video for Magar.
So how are you feeling about all this at this point? Like you sort of have this producing career that's on the rise, becoming more high profile, working on these great records. And, you know, you had this band forever and now you're a solo artist for the first time and getting some attention. Like where were you feeling like everything was going at that point?
Well, downhill, because I was already 35. I mean, it's like, you know, there was never a 30-year-old Beatle. And, you know, I can see the handwriting on the wall. I know this isn't something that's going to sustain. You know, I hope you want to have a hit, but, you know, I was under no delusions that I was going to have hits. It was still about just trying to do things that you could stand to look at yourself in the mirror. I mean, I do think recording ruined music. So it's like, I feel like, you know, if we didn't have recording, there'd be a lot more happy people singing and playing songs around the campfire and in their living rooms at night. And live music. I mean, when I grew up, there was a live band that played on the radio 3 hours a day in Lancaster, South Carolina, playing the hits of the day. So it's like, and that was super common. That was not abnormal at all.
I would guess that being opposed to recorded music is a minority opinion among record producers.
right. But it's just, it shouldn't have happened, you know, unfortunately, because it captures these songs in amber in a way that is not always the best thing for the song or for the, you know, it just sets up it. They become icons and they're not real in a way. I mean, I don't know. It's a complicated, I stand in a complicated crossroads with recording.
But you did go on to produce, you know, to record several more records afterwards. I mean, you had Romeo at Juilliard 2 years later and, you know, so you kept making music. Is that because, you know, you write songs and you want to record them and you want to get them out into the world?
Yeah, I mean, that's the only way to do it, except playing. And I've continued to play a lot. And I don't play as much as I probably should have. I've never played quite as much as I probably should have. But I've still played a lot. And I mean, during the Arrogance era, you know, we played at least 150 shows a year. So that's 13 years of at least 150 shows a year with that band. And then as a solo artist, I probably back down to 60 or so. But and then I still tour with Mary Chapin as her bass player. So that's another bunch of times.
Yeah, I was wondering if you were still doing that.
Mm-hmm. Well, she's just not touring this year. She's got taken a couple of years off.
Yeah.
But we played, I guess we played in 2023. We toured last summer. We're just not doing it this summer.
How did you like being a solo artist versus being in a band?
Being a solo artist is great. And as you get older, it's even better. I mean, I can, you know, I had a trio that I played with a lot for a while. And but just playing completely by yourself and or Marty and I played together. My wife, who I met through producing, you know, she and I have been playing together since the mid 80s as well. So even though she's kind of retired, she's tired of being stared at, is what she likes to say. But, you know, I'm still, I mean, I still record. I put out stuff. I just don't put out physical things so much because unless you're touring, there's really no place to sell anything physical. So, but I have a lot of stuff out there. I put out a little record called Gunny Sack last year that has a bunch of things I recorded during the pandemic on it.
Do you still write pretty often?
Yeah, I wrote a bunch of songs for a guy named John Bear who writes murder mysteries about Chapel Hill. Or he's written two murder mysteries so far about this character named Lassie James. And so far for both of his Lassie James books, I have written songs with his lyrics for these records that have come out. So I think all that stuff's on Spotify. And the last version, Marty even sings a few of the songs because it's supposed to be a band that made a tape in 1982. And so these are supposed to be the songs that the band recorded to try to get a job in Chapel Hill in 1982. So I'm still writing and playing and producing beautiful, cool new band called Secret Monkey Weekend. New Peter Holzapfel record, by the way. We're back, circle around a Peter, this fantastic new record of his that we've just finished up.
Oh, cool. Where'd you record that?
We tracked it. It's almost exclusively done at a studio in Durham called Overdub Lane, I think it's called. But it was a nice little studio. It's been around a long time. And it's really good. And Peter sings and plays his ass off.
Nice. I'd love to hear that. I heard some of the stuff he was doing during the pandemic. He had a song canceled and some other stuff. But yeah, I'd love to hear it.
This is really, you know, the very good sounding, muscular guitar record. We use the bass player from Ben Folds 5, Robert Sledge, who is a North Carolina kid, brilliant player, and my good friend Rob Ladd on drums, and another brilliant musician, and pretty much cut it live-ish, and a few overdubs, and Peter sang, and I mixed it here at my studio.
So did you like leaving home to go record something back in North Carolina?
I love recording. I record. I've never owned a studio where I could really record people like full bands very easily because I don't want to have that responsibility. But fortunately, friends like my friends Wayne Jernigan and Mitch Easter, and there are still great studios around, and I like to use them.
Right. And when you're at home, do you and Marty just like spend an evening singing songs together?
Never. Marty, I don't pay her enough for her to sit around and sing with me.
You don't go out like in the backyard and have a little hootenanny, invite the neighbors over to do sing-alongs, fire pit?
This you'll find this funny. The last time we ever had sat around with guitars in the backyard was when Chris Isaak was playing in Cleveland about, I don't know, 1998 or something. And we had toured with Chris. Marty spent almost 6 months opening for Chris. And we became real good friends with the band and him. And they came down, had a night off. They came down for supper. And we sat around in the backyard while Chris entertain us with all the songs he knows. And we might have passed the guitar around and played a few ourselves.
That sounds like a good deal, though. Yeah, get Chris Isaak to do a backyard concert.
Well, it wasn't a concert. It was just the band and us. But we don't sit around doing that very often. Mark, it's great talking to you. I hope I haven't bored you too much.
No, this has been fantastic. Thanks so much, Don. My wife's last name is Dixon, so you guys, I'm sure, are cousins at some way or other.
You're kidding.
All right, great talking to you.
See you, man. Bye.
That's all for episode 136 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Don Dixon for all of the great music, written, performed, and produced, and the stories to go with it. Dixon maintains a relatively low profile with no tour dates scheduled or merch to buy, but I encourage you to dig into those Arrogance albums, to check out his solo work, and to create a playlist of songs he has produced. You'll have a happy time with it. Chris Swake produced this Carol Pop episode especially for you. For a mere $24, you can become a Carol Pop friend and help keep this thing going. Please contribute at carolpop.com. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at Carol Popcast. You could follow me as well at Mark Caro, at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop Conversation. Thanks.